This week's episode of the SGGQA podcast is brought to you by Frame It. You've just shot a great piece of video, but now you need to frame it. Phones are crazy powerful options for video editing, but a lot of our editing apps still try to work like desktop video software. Frame It gives you streamlined tools to do more advanced edits, but with controls that are a better fit for your phone screen. Use the actions you're already familiar with, like pinch to zoom and rotate, just like you're editing a photo, but with video. Pan, zoom, rotate, and crop as easily as scanning your photo gallery. Time your pans and movements to music. Punch in for dramatic effect. Flip through a transition or fix a video for the right orientation. Load up a video and Frame It will record your edits and moves in real time. Trim out parts of a clip you don't need, and the app renders out all of your edits as a finished clip. Fast, easy, powerful. Frame It is free and available now on Google Play. Your video's not really done until you frame it. For more info on Frame It and tutorials on how to get the best edits out of your phone camera, head on over to frameitapp.com. Once again, frameitapp.com. I want to thank Frame It for supporting the SGGQA podcast. And now, let's get on with the show. Well, hello there. OBS just dumped me out of the video. We are live, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm always stoked. There have been a few partnerships on this podcast, a few sponsored spots, and again, I want to throw a thank you to Frame It for sponsoring this week's show. It's been a really fun app to use and to play with, and so I hope you folks check it out. Dave Burns, how do I let them know you're a shill? Well, seeing as how that was a sponsored spot, and I have received monies for the communication of that app and service, I'm pretty sure they know. And Vazicos 8, I hate Instagram for making portrait video popular. I mean, can't we take that back to Vine? Wasn't Vine the originator of portrait video? Folks, this is going to be a super scattered, wacky brain podcast. I'm on like 3 hours sleep. I'm trying to wrap up projects for a couple of different outlets. I'm writing scripts. I'm trying to shoot videos. I've got a reviews.org deadline that I'm trying to meet. And I'm trying to keep this really simple. But if you notice over my left shoulder here, there's nothing on the bookcase anymore except for a plain brown cardboard box. And that's because my family were finally packing up and we're moving. We're going to be leaving this condo unit that we've been in for the last just over a year. And we're going to be moving to a place that hopefully we'll be able to settle in and just stay for a while. And we're really excited about that. But of course, we're right in the middle of work. I just got jury duty. So I've got a summons for jury duty that I've got to handle. And we're packing and trying to move stuff between these two homes. So I'm all over the place right now. This is great. You want like lots of tangents and rambling, and this is going to be the podcast for you. My brain is going to have struggles with the concept of linear thought and through line. So I hope everyone here had a phenomenal weekend, had a great weekend. We really did. I mean, it is good times. It is really exciting. But of course, in even the happiest of excitement, the happiest of exciting times, it's still an anxious energy, right? Excitement is an exhausting energy to sort of sustain. So, DTNL, do you even Gadget Lab, bro? Yeah, we're closing down Gadget Lab 3, and I want to say a little bit of a goodbye to Gadget Lab 3 at the end of this podcast. So we'll chat that out, because Gadget Lab 3, I don't feel like ever really fully materialized. Gadget Lab 3 was sort of a holding position as we weathered global pandemic. We've got a lot of news to cover. There's a lot of broadband and industry news. And so I want to try and push through that. I want to try and fly through that. all of these are stories that we've been trying to keep track of, to follow up on. This is some encouraging trends. And especially for those of you who have been kind of keeping track of like broadband and net neutrality, I think there's some interesting stuff happening. We've got phones to talk about, LG Swan Song, which is only being sold to employees. We've got a new phone from Sharp, the Aquos. I want to get your thoughts on Pixel 6. So for the second part of this, the gadget block, we've got a lot to chew through right there. And Gary the Fireman jumping in with some tier one subs, gifting to Aditya Anil and ER1980. Again, right off the bat, much appreciated supporting the production on this stream, on this channel. I really do appreciate that. And one of the topics that we're going to talk about, just this notion of reviewers and the YouTube drama that's kind of surrounding our little community, and just how strained and toxic that kind of social media drama can be. We're all kind of dealing with those existential life crises. Over the last 2 years, you've been hearing me air my own dirty laundry about where I want this channel to go, what I think we should start focusing on, trying to get out of some of these old habits. And I think that there's increasing pressure to talk about change, what it is that we hope to deliver, the stories that we want to tell. And so that's going to be a little part of what our podcast is going to be about today. Also, and another tier one sub, Gary the Fireman, gifting to Al Spockley. Oh, man, Gary, you're rocking my socks. I really do appreciate it. Simply Your Device. YouTube? Drama? No. Dave Burns, the YouTube drama I missed by participating less and less on YouTube. I'm probably better off for it. Not probably, you definitely are. Let's jump into some housekeeping, because housekeeping is going to lead us into this conversation about YouTube, drama, reviewers, and just what our expectations as audience members should be. Simon says Hypno. That is absolutely the case. It's almost like YouTube uses that drama to increase views. Matt Tyler, YouTube drama is better than soaps on TV. I don't know. I'm kind of I'm not going to be ashamed to admit that I was a sucker for All My Children and One Life to Live. When you've got a kind of a background in performance and you see soap opera actors just grinding it out. I mean, they're getting scripts on the day. They're shooting practically like live to tape, you know, like there's got to be very little room for editing. The storylines have to keep topping what happened, you know, the week before. The storylines have to keep evolving in the strangest possible ways. Soap operas are incredible. How they're produced, how over the top and melodramatic they are. I'm a sucker for good melodrama, you know, really goofy, cartoony, you know, again, stagey presentation. I don't know that YouTube drama is nearly as satisfying, especially because it's real people doing fakery to gin up that drama, whereas soap operas are sort of actors just barely finger gripping onto their scripts and their production, finishing shows by the skin of their teeth. And it's wonderfully conceptualized exercises in an absurd fiction. YouTube is not nearly as fun. All right. Sorry. Juan loves drama. I do not believe it. I like fictionalized drama. I don't like drama between real people, again, with the chest puffery of reality TV, which is what YouTube is kind of encouraging from our community. Let's jump into some housekeeping. It's already 9:08. This is my third cup of coffee because, like I said, I'm running on fumes sleep-wise. This is the Andrew Wallace got me this mug, by the way. This is the Orville Planetary Union mug. It's one of my favorite mugs, outside of my own, of course, collectible mugs, which are packed. I was in such a rush to clean out the bookshelf that I wrapped up all of my Megapickle and Headphone Jack mugs, so I have no props. I have no props. I need to shoot on a phone that I'm under embargo for, and I would normally, like, prop it up against one of my mugs. Don't got them because I'm dumb. All right, let's get into some housekeeping. I want to start off housekeeping. Where did I put it? There it is. I want to start off housekeeping. I'm always so geekily Twitter-pated. One of my favorite long-running Android podcasts. They're I need to express as a fan of this podcast. I spend so much time with their voices in my ears. And I don't know about you, but when you're listening to a podcast, I hold imaginary conversations with the podcast hosts. They bring up a point and immediately in my brain. I don't know, maybe it's because I do a lot of talking to cameras. Maybe other people don't do this, but I you know, respond to the point they make and I bring up a question. And I think, where would that conversation go if I were really sitting with them? I cannot express how much of a nerdy, giddy head trip it is when I hear their voices in my head and I say something and then they respond. It is still like weird magic when that goes down. There are so many podcasts I'm a fan of, but this is just like, I've had the longest running personal relationship with All About Android. And so I'm where is my fire? Again, I keep moving my tabs around in OBS. There we go. I can turn that off there too. Okay, good. So I don't even know what episode number they're on anymore. They're not even labeling their episode numbers, but Gaming Phones Get Good, a Black Shark 4 review, two-factor authentication default on Google and Clubhouse on Android. I was with Ron and Flo Ion just chatting out, and it was just an amazing way to kind of spend a Tuesday afternoon, a DTN Hill, Juan versus Jason Howell, pay-per-view 3. I don't want to take it personally. We're not stirring up drama on this podcast, but a little behind the scenes at All About Android, Jason had a personal situation. He wasn't able to host his normal hosting duties at All About Android, and they wanted a third. And they called me on the day, just said, hey, could you jump in on this? And we're like, yeah, of course, I'd love to join. And they're like, okay, good, because Jason can't come. And he's like, why does Jason always bail when I'm on the show? I think over the last couple of years, I might need to look through. I think from my very first appearance to my last appearance on All About Android, I think only twice have I ever had like the full cast of All About Android. ER1980, thank you. Episode 524. I'm bad with numbers. I'm terrible at naming my own podcast. I love joining their show. I love sparring with Ron because we've got kind of like some differing ideologies on like business and features and I love commiserating with Flo as we talk about like accessibility and bringing more services and protecting consumers. Like, there's just so much joy whenever I get to jump in on All About Android. So that was one of the biggies, definitely one of the highlights of my week. Moving right along, let me click back into screen share here. On the Patreon, I kind of teased this a couple weeks back, talking about how I've got a process for writing scripts. This article on Patreon is called, Do You Really Get More Phone When You Spend More? And it's a video script that I started writing as soon as I got the Xiaomi Mi 11 Lite. Excuse me. And every single time I would kind of get through the intro of that video and I'd start writing, the script just kept getting meaner and meaner in my head. The crux of it is I wanted to sort of showcase the performance differences or the expectations that we should have looking at a OnePlus 9, which I've been very positive on. I think the OnePlus 9 is a brilliant competitor against phones like iPhone 12s, if we're looking like hardware to hardware. But then the Xiaomi, I keep wanting to say Xi, and I think it's more of a Xiaomi. Anyway, the Mi 11 Lite came around and really rocked my socks for kind of blurring the lines on what this premium tier should look like. If you want an attractive, slim phone, good features, it joins the conversation with Nord N10s, the Moto Ace, and the TCLs that I've really enjoyed, but kind of refining that idea. I keep writing this script, and it just keeps devolving into this is media commentary, and let me tell you what's wrong with YouTube, and this is what's up with other reviewers, and I have a confrontational tone naturally, so when I lean into that, it starts to get acidic. I don't like the sound of my own voice when that becomes sort of the focus point. I like poking fun at established truisms that I don't think are actually true. I don't like kind of regurgitating bile over and over and over again. So I posted the script just kind of as a thought piece. Like, this is where this video could have gone. And I got what's beautiful and why I'm so grateful for the community over on the Patreon is, like, I got a couple comments just saying, like, hey, you know, we can hear this in your voice. It doesn't sound as bad as you think it does. it's not as mean as you think it is. And there's a good idea in this script in there. And so I'm going to let it settle for just a bit. Like, I'm not going to try and force it. I'm not going to try and roll right back into it. But there's a concept of this idea. You know, again, I want to compare a phone that costs twice as much as another phone. And what are the expectations? Do you really get twice as much phone for the price? Because I feel like we too often glaze over those kinds of conversations without really digging in and giving that idea. There's some meat to that idea. It's just how to properly present it. And not in a way where I'm just ranting and railing about other reviewers. Oh, Dave Burns, the TCL 20 Pro and the Xiaomi are the premium mid-ranger replacement for the Velvet, I guess. Actually, when it comes to the Velvet, because that's the other thing that I put out, this one will go public next week. Yes, it should be going public next week. I did a revisit. This is exactly what I'm talking about, how I get sidetracked. All right, so this is currently live on the Patreon, but it will go public in about a week. And I did an LG revisit, the last great feature mid-ranger. Dave Burns, you gave me the perfect segue there. This was really only going to be a quick follow-up because the Velvet has its Android 11 update. Well, the South Korean version of the Velvet has its Android 11 update. Let me drill that down one layer deeper. The South Korean version of the Velvet with the Snapdragon 765, the 5G model, has its Android 11 update. I don't believe the 845 version does, and I know that the MediaTek version doesn't. As if we want to relitigate some of the issues with LG and distribution. So I started talking. Like, I was really just going to do, you know, these are the bullet points, this is what I feel. And what came out was like 40 minutes of me, well, this is what I feel about this, and this was the price, and this is how we, you know, can focus on that. And it's so interesting how we rewrite history. I shared a link to this on YouTube, and so I got some comments from people that really didn't watch the video. Again, the YouTube replies are very rarely the patrons, because if you're on Patreon, you can just reply on the Patreon. And a lot of people are like, hey, I know, like, you keep talking about how this phone was like a mid-ranger competitor, but it was too expensive. And like, it really wasn't. This phone launched at the same price as a Galaxy A71. Oh, but in my region, if I jumped through hoops, I could get a deal on this and that. No. AT&T unlocked. It launched at the same price, phone to phone. But it was more expensive because you had to buy the dual display. You didn't have to buy the dual display. If you wanted an A71, but with a glass back, wireless charging, USB 3, a full desktop mode, and stylus support, like a Note Lite, you could just buy the phone. You didn't have to buy the dual display. And it's so... It's confirming, right? It's not surprising. It's still a little disappointing, but in our heads, I went back just to double check, and I caught a bunch of reviews of the Galaxy A71. What a great bargain for those of you who are interested in 5G. Look, this is Samsung cutting all the right corners so that you have, you know, the features that you mostly care about, and it's on a decently powerful device. And so much of the commentary on Velvet was, well, it's kind of pretty, but it's really too expensive for what you get. And 30 minutes of this just kind of flowed out of my face. So I ended up just posting, I edited out some stuff where I was going off on crazy tangents. Not quite talking about like appliances and consumerism, but definitely just my feelings on what might be the last great feature-packed mid-ranger. Because for the price of an A71, I don't think there's anything that's really touching what the Velvet had to offer. And the update to Screen Plus, I mean, again, as LG is walking out the door, they're showing like some of the best polish on software features we've ever seen. And I've been using the Velvet again because I can game and watch video at the same time on a dual display. I can plug it into a Next Dock, or actually I've been using the U-Perfect more frequently. And like, I've been writing my scripts on the Velvet. You know, it's nuts what this phone was really capable of and how we kind of wrote it off because it wasn't good enough. It needed to be more and cheaper. So, Blue Man Rule, I really love my LG Velvet. Thanks to your unbiased coverage, it's a fantastic phone. It came at an awkward time because I know a lot of us wanted a G9. The G8 was such a good phone. I wanted to see what their follow-up was going to be. LG pivoted and moved towards cost savings while still trying to keep feature-packed devices. And Velvet, I don't think we really got Velvet until it was kind of too late to get Velvet. You know what I mean? Even in my own coverage, I really feel like I probably should have followed it up more aggressively. But what kind of sucked some of the wind out of my sails was just trying to divide the conversation between international version and the T-Mobile version, which was a little bit different. And it's hard for me to wrap my brain around how do I talk about that product when you've got to like take so many different people into consideration for who might be picking one up. So, Matt Tyler subscribed, a tier one sub. Thanks, Matt. Thank you again for jumping on. I as soon as I'm moved and I can dedicate some more brain space to this stuff, I've got to improve, like have like some kind of fanfare. You know, someone subscribed. Maybe I'll just do a voice, an audio sample of that, and I'll have a soundboard. Someone subscribed. Just like that. You make that a ringtone. It's told, you can just take it. I give you permission to sample my voice. For public videos, we got a lot out last week considering how rocked my family's been. Let me cue this back up here, Firefox. I got my OnePlus 9 Pro review out. This is a 26 minute video chatting OnePlus 9 Pro, my experiences using it, and some of the things that have really been cleaned up after the most recent software updates. Still some concerns. It's a OnePlus, so there are always going to be a few little sticky bits, but I feel like that's increasingly true of every manufacturer these days. I'm not conflicted. I find it is very easy to recommend a OnePlus 9 Pro if someone is shopping premium tier. It's just been a solid phone. It only just recently stopped housing my SIM card, my personal SIM card. I went and did something dumb. My SIM card is now in a phone that I can't talk about. So we're just going to move on from there. The other fun video that I got out this week, and this is slowly becoming a series that I feel like I need to be working on more directly, talking about photography, mobile video, improving our content. I'm trying to reply to the sort of, again, truisms that aren't quite true. And I'll see like comments in my videos like, well, you know, this is what's wrong with using faster frame rates. Like if you shoot 60 frame per second video, the video is going to be darker. And you kind of get some data and you come to the wrong conclusion on that data. And then it's really hard to reset, like to bring people back and to really explain what the concept actually is. So I put this video together talking about the difference between shutter speed and frame rate, but for video. So we've got a really, I feel like a lot of techies have a pretty solid grasp, shutter speed for photos. But because you don't often have shutter speed control for video, the idea of how we control light for video gets blurred. And most people only look at, well, I'm shooting 24 frames per second, I'm shooting 30, I'm shooting 60. Now you can shoot 120 in 4K. The concept of shutter speed becomes even more critical to a phone because we don't have other tools. We don't have other ways to control light. We don't have an aperture to control the iris of a phone. We don't have neutral density filters easily accessible for a lot of phones out there. So one of the main ways that we control for brightness is by using faster and faster shutter speeds. And as camera sensors get larger, we're going to be talking about that Sharp Aquis with a 1-inch sensor. That's a real big piece of glass to have on the back of a phone. And the aperture on that is going to be humongous and the depth of field is going to be crazy. So it's increasingly critical so that our video doesn't get completely blown out if we happen to shoot during daylight conditions, that we understand, like, what is it that actually controls for the light on our video. So DTNL hashtag some almost broke NDA guy. Yeah, that's me. McCorkran 3. Now that Samsung is nerfing the fast charging and OnePlus is going all in, everyone on social media is worried about long-term battery health. I don't remember everyone hating fast charging when Samsung was emphasizing it. So I did bring that up in my OnePlus 9 review. There are so many of these battery technologies that, to your point, and why I agree with you. Sorry, let me just say I agree with you, especially the narrative, is Samsung does something like reverse wireless charging and nerds go out and praise it. OnePlus offers up much, much faster wired and wireless charging, and now suddenly we're concerned. And what's frustrating is that there is an actual concern there, right? Yeah, I really do have concerns about, 45-watt wireless charging on the OnePlus Pad. It charges faster wirelessly than most other phones charge cabled, which means you're generating more heat, you're putting additional wear and tear on the battery, and it's an option. See, and that's what a premium phone should do. It should give us options. And I feel like we've turned this into a zero-sum game. It's all or nothing. If you're going to buy that wireless pad, you're only ever going to charge a phone on that wireless pad and it's going to destroy your battery. Well, you have a choice. And I feel like there's a totally reasonable suggestion to say, get a OnePlus where you get that amazing charger in the box and then also pick up an inexpensive, slower charger when you don't need to. Or if you're the type of person who likes to charge overnight, let it trickle charge. Let it plug it into like a USB port on your computer and let it charge super slow. And that's what's frustrating. We'll jump through hoops to explain those options on Apple. We'll jump through hoops to explain those options on Samsung. But then OnePlus gives us better options in many ways. And then it's, oh no, now it's a concern. Now are you concerned? I'm concerned. And that's a bummer. Gary the Fireman, and especially coming from Gary the Fireman, Gary the Fireman, battery cooking. Benefit of the doubt, Adam, absolutely. I loved Sony's software feature to slowly charge overnight, and especially how their power management will let you kind of cap. Sony with HS power control. Again, if we were really concerned about battery charging tech, we wouldn't just be looking at Samsung kind of
cutting their fast charging off at the knees, we'd highlight a company that's doing that really well. But of course, the commentary around Sony sort of stops at, I don't even know how to say their name anymore. Xperia 1III? What even is that? So no, we're doomed. We're doomed as a species. Because that's kind of the piece that I want to wrap housekeeping with, but then also share just some last additional thoughts. So over the last... the last 2 weeks, we've seen another round of YouTuber drama. Someone made a video replying to an old video about how YouTube reviewers are just leaning into consumerism and are just marketing arms, and you don't get any value out of the commentary. It's no different than buying appliances, buying a phone. And that kicked off just another round of hot takes. I'm going to reply to this reply. I'm going to write a rebuttal to this reply of a reply. And every single time this goes down, it just creates a drama echo chamber where, as a tech community, we're not talking about tech. We're talking about the tech community in the community. You know, it's just a circular, insular echo chamber. And someone from the outside looking in would look at this and be like, this looks sad and ridiculous. So I shared some thoughts in a standalone video, in an editorial, fake reviewers and YouTube drama. And just so that I wasn't a complete hypocrite, that video is only available on Twitch. I did not post that video to YouTube because I'm genuinely trying to avoid feeding the YouTube algorithm more drama. But in that video, I also talked about some of my most recent experiences with commentary critiquing review trends. And if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, I mean, we talked about the incident where I wrote an editorial replying to a larger YouTuber and kind of picking apart their video process to show kind of how lazy and uninformed that video was. And that immediately garnered a huge amount of attention. It was conflict. I called this individual out by name. People were in my DM saying like, oh, you've got to go after these other people, or you've got to turn this into a video. And it's just a rabid, sick thrill hunger watching YouTubers and content creators clash, watching us destroy our mental health for sort of the public's entertainment. And so, again, this video also serves to kind of clear the air on why I hold a confrontational tone in many of my reviews. But at the same time, I'm not looking to pick fights with specific people, where I really am genuinely trying to pick apart a trend. Like, I see a number of comments. You have to understand, like, this conversation is more one-sided than it's ever been. You used to go to YouTube and go to the comments and see active conversations much more readily. But YouTube is working very hard at separating the creator from their audience. They're a wedge in between the viewers and the creators. So even down into something like comments, the comments are now kind of tucked away in a slightly less accessible way to kind of interact with. And again, it's just about artificially hyping up the quick, easy, low-hanging fruit of social media drama, of low-effort commentary, of reality TV show chest puffery, where there's lots of big talk. I'm gonna tell you what's going down, but nothing really ever happens because that's not real. Like, that's not real life. Cabaletta, do you even shorts, brah? And again, look at that. You know, like, YouTube's big move is ripping off TikTok. We're going to pay out $100 million to the creators that get the best engagement on YouTube Shorts. What could possibly go wrong with that plan? So I did want to just kind of wrap up this sentiment, because I feel like it sucked all the air out of tech commentary for a couple weeks now. But I also found that there was like an interesting side effect of what went down. And I feel like I'm not trying to be a gatekeeper, but I still am very, very sensitive to the trends that I think are troubling in the review space. And I feel it. We need to do a better job of calling out some of those bad trends, but to do so in ways that kind of help encourage a broader community of people coming to the table. I feel the best way to get in the way or to disrupt bad review trends is to bring more reviewers on board, more voices, broader community, healthier ranks. We're bringing more people into the fold, and there's going to be more back and forth, crosstalk, pollinating of ideas. So I've seen this one recently where this topic gets brought up, and then immediately, like, there's this thirsty, try-hard defense of larger YouTubers. And like this condemnation of the idea that, you know, well, I mean, reviewers, you can't expect reviewers to do their jobs. Like, you can't expect reviewers to do long-term follow-ups on every phone. I mean, that's not feasible. You know, when you are a larger YouTube channel, you're a business and you've got other mouths to feed. So, you know, if their videos don't hit, well, then I guess you need to pivot and only make the good kinds of videos.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
And I disagree. I feel the disclosure of the channel should influence the kind of content that they produce. If you're an individual like Renee Ritchie has worked very hard to upfront describe the kind of content you should expect from Renee Ritchie. There are other larger channels that purport to be all-rounder, average consumer, unbiased tech reviewers. But then when you scan through the content of their videos, there's a very clear trend towards popularity. When I was at Pocket Now, we had very frank discussions on what's monetizing and how do we deliver consistent reviews. You know, we know that we're going to put out these videos on like motos and ZTEs, and they're not going to hit. They're not going to deliver as much traffic as our Samsung and Apple coverage. But if our Samsung and Apple coverage is healthy, then those bigger videos should help us subsidize a consistent review practice for all of the smaller brands. And we also had frank conversations about, well, maybe we can't. Maybe we can't do that. You know, I stopped doing the camera reviews for Pocket Now because we got to a point where we're like, hey, you know, a camera review on LG is doing half or a quarter the amount of traffic as a camera review for a Samsung. So maybe we should only do camera reviews for Samsungs. So this is why I think it's critical. I have so much love and respect for what John Redinger has been doing lately. He is finding a new method of storytelling that's so much more personal and so much more interesting. And he's doing it by not pretending to be an all-rounder, objective reviewer. He's delivering commentary that is so much more in line with his own personal feelings. Now, the positive of that is like, wow, we really get to know John's preference. the negative way to say that. Oh, John's just biased. You see how that cuts both ways. They're both true. Because we're humans. We all have personal preferences. We all have bias. So I don't believe in this argument. Well, if you're running a media machine, you can't be objective, because if some of your videos underperform, you can't pay for your staff. Okay. If that's true, then that channel needs to give up the idea of them being all-rounder tech authorities. They need to walk away from, oh, where this is objectively what average consumers are going to be caring about most, and we're only going to talk about Sam Apple. You can't have it both ways. So out of this whole conversation, where I'm not trying to say, well, this is a real reviewer and this is a fake reviewer, but what I would ask for is, if your channel is built on some notion of all-rounder tech commentary, of broad tech coverage, and you can't really handle that consistently, then it's time for you to pivot. And it's time to just give that up. I mean, there's a new Sony channel, but it's not really a new channel. They were a previously established all-rounder tech outlet. And then they saw their traffic, and then they personally said, hey, we really want to talk about Sony stuff. And they pivoted and turned their YouTube channel into a Sony focus piece. And they were upfront about it. Was it Sony 365 or something like that? I forget what the name of the channel was before. Do it. Do it. We only want to do Samsung versus Apple coverage. Great. There's so much meat there. Go for it. And make those conversations more personal. But don't pretend you're giving us the full scoop on average consumers when you're ignoring a majority of the devices that average consumers are actually buying. You know, like this is a part of the game that absolutely needs to stop. And it's all informed by YouTube. YouTube manipulates our feeds, you know, changes up our relationship with our subscribers, front loads topics that YouTube knows will already be popular, targets different demographics of people to only see certain types of content. The only way we can get back to some semblance of more fair or more consistent tech coverage is to walk away from YouTube spoon-feeding us every single topic, every single piece, because YouTube doesn't care about fair. YouTube doesn't care about consistency. YouTube only cares about time on site. Are your eyeballs on YouTube? Great. They'll manipulate to the finest, most niche, you know, toxic version of our community. And it won't benefit us. It's not going to help us. It's going to wreck our channels, but it'll make YouTube more money. So again, I want to be sensitive to this. I feel like it's fair to look at a channel's overall history and see what claims are they making. Are they claiming to be a broad tech authority, but then only covering the topics that are most popular? And I don't think that's okay. And again, it comes with this weird corollary. Well, maybe if smaller channels want to do the longer term wrap-ups. Yeah, I mean, if you run a little channel and you can afford to just throw your time away, I mean, that can work for you. Screw you. No, seriously. If that's your suggestion, or if that's like your assessment of like bigger channels versus smaller channels, then I have no patience for that. You know, if you're working hard, you deserve a fair shot at the audience that's already subscribed to your channel. You shouldn't have to suffer YouTube getting in the way. And then, you know, a bunch of, you know, sort of talking head commentary. Well, I mean, like bigger channels just can't afford. I mean, they're getting millions and millions of views. They can't afford to follow up on a phone. That makes zero sense. It makes no sense at all. I saw a highlighted comment and I wanted to get back to it here. For Matt Tyler, YouTube needs to recognize its actual creators. Gary explains should easily be 1 million subs. Juan, TK, Jason, Zach, Jermaine, I can keep going. These are the people who deserve the attention. Instead, we are left to share push to share push because YouTube favors when it shouldn't favor anyone. And I feel like that's absolutely fair. Is again, some channels get the full weight of the YouTube algorithm in support of their subscribers, and other channels seem to be interrupted or separated from their subscribers. And Aditya Anil, John Redinger, is doing a fun job. Like, we all know he's an Apple fanboy, but it's so emotional and well-constructed that I love it. I love stories. There are some channels I have zero idea what this content creator does with their phones. Like, they talk about the phone and they read off the spec sheet and they show us the pretty B-roll, but like, they don't game on their phones. They use their laptop for work. They've got a really nice camera to shoot all their B-roll. So what do they do on their phones? And I can never get a handle on that. And John is not like that. From John, I get a very clear sense, and especially recently, because he's been doing such a good job of personalizing his experiences, the story is so much more interesting. And then he also has a great team making his production value look super rad. So, I mean, like, I can't compete with that kind of production value, but I'm way more interested in telling a story than I am just reading specs off at you to say, but it's not worth it because another phone is more popular. Is not something that I enjoy or appreciate. Ballbury viewers, why do I get the same recommendations all the time? YouTube, we've changed our algorithm. Also viewers, why am I getting so many different recommendations? Oh, good times. All right. So that was housekeeping. Just a good 40 minutes of housekeeping there. And Dave Burns says, my issue with bigger channels is that I feel like they're so broad, I'm not learning anything. What I've come to feel on a number, not all, but on a number of larger tech channels, is you will not maintain an audience if you are too specific. And so I mean by that is, we can already see a clear trend where if a larger channel covers a less popular product, it's through the prism of talking to Samsung and Apple owners. I'm going to review this. I'm going to review an LG, but I'm not really going to review the LG. I'm going to tell Samsung and Apple owners why they were smart to not buy the LG, right? We've already been seeing that, I would say, since the G7. That seems to be the clear trend. I know more people are coming to my channel from Samsung and Apple audience, demographics. So the review is immediately crouched in a comparison against the products that they likely own from Samsung and Apple, as opposed to just an assessment of the product itself. But lately, there's more and more of this casual filler. You know, the phrase average consumer has become a toxic indicator of zero substance, because they can't define what average consumer use is. They aren't using the products to any greater degree, because they don't need to, and because they're going to flip it the next week over and get another super premium expensive phone. They're not living with these products to really get a feel for what makes them unique. It's mostly specs reading and then pretty B-roll. So when you start listening to the content of that video, what you end up with is a lot of just generalizations that are super vague, so that an audience member can insert their own opinion. Well, what average consumers care about are cameras that just work. Does your camera just work? Is it a just work camera? Or do you need to make an effort to get good shots out of that camera? Boiling this down to such a knuckle-dragging lowest common denominator eventually arrives at some place where you're just occupying space. You're sort of fogging noise. And then the viewer can feel like their own bias is being confirmed when you really haven't said anything. You've talked a lot, but you haven't said anything. hey, y'all, so I've been doing this video for exactly 8 minutes now so that I can add extra ads to the flow of this video. YouTube lets me put in ads now that I've been talking for 8 minutes. So what do you think? I get it. You're trying to, it's a call to action. You're looking for engagement. You want comments, but like, you've said nothing for 8 minutes and now you're saying, but what do you think about this thing that I've been talking about? You didn't come to a conclusion. First, I'd just like to get what is your, you can't give me a conclusion because if your conclusion is too specific, you'll upset a larger block of consumers. Just admitting that OnePlus, LG, Xiaomi, Motorola can make Sony, can make a competitive product will upset Samsung and Apple owners because Samsung and Apple owners don't want to hear other products might be competitive. They want to hear you got the best and you deserve the best. And that's, YouTube is laughing all the way to the bank. YouTube's algorithm is reinforcing that and hitting it harder and harder and harder. Paul Puri, you need a jump to conclusions board game. Oh, and Tech Loving Mama's in the chat. Everyone say, hey, Tech Loving Mama. All right. So we do have some news. Like I said, the news block, I wanted to kind of abbreviate a little bit. These are really quick follow-up stories. Obviously, everything that we're talking about today, my rambling mess of housekeeping, everything's going to be on the show notes for this week's episode on somegadgetguy.com. These are really critical follow-ups to our stories about broadband and infrastructure. We recently got news that the FCC had approved billions of dollars in infrastructure and for the emergency broadband benefit. Again, I would highly recommend reaching out to your family and friends because this is rolling out soon to see who might qualify. And a lot of people think, well, I'm not really in a low-income household, but the criteria for the emergency broadband benefit, they're a little bit more accessible than some of these other access programs have been in the past. On top of that, the FCC has just finalized another $7 billion connectivity fund. This is coming from marketbrief.edweek.org, an education write-up on Marketplace for schools and education. So this is David Rauf, I believe, who wrote this up. This is going to be linked in the show notes. Please read through this. I cannot cover this in the podcast. Like, this would be a 4-hour podcast, but this is a great write-up looking at what is qualifying for funding, what does not qualify for funding. And it's all about empowering schools to hook up their students. So modems, hotspots, better access for things like laptops. Samsung was lobbying the FCC hard to include phones, which would have been awesome because I think decks in the education space could be epic, but it wouldn't have just been Samsung phones, right? You know, like iPhones can't do decks. So not as useful for education. So unfortunately, the FCC nixed smartphone spending. $7 billion is going to be going out to try and get students and teachers better hooked up, better connected. Right now, kids are trying to get their homework done in the parking lots of fast food restaurants just to piggyback on some Wi-Fi. We can do better. So check that out. I think this is a brilliant, just a brilliant move, and one where I'm happy, I'm proud, I'm excited for my tax dollars to be spent on an initiative like this. Moving right along, we've got two complementary stories on public broadband and broadband infrastructure out on the West Coast. Ooh, ooh. First up, our current governor here in California isn't polling the most popular, but he at least piqued my curiosity when, again, the $7 billion seems to be a nice round number for government agencies talking about broadband. Oops, there we go. California governor proposes $7 billion investment in public broadband. Newsom claims the state will close the digital divide if it's approved. This is mostly about getting underserved communities up to speed, but a major part of this is also going to be, this was written up by Chris Holt over at Engadget. A major part of this is going to be California will get to work on one of the biggest public broadband fiber network projects in the United States. And this is getting ahead of the story that we talked about a couple weeks back, where we're considering changing the definition of broadband, and one of the proposals is matched 100 megabit connections, symmetrical upload and download speeds of 100 meg. And the only way we can do that is if we finally walk away from cable. Cable prevents us from getting these faster upload speeds because it was really built as a downstream connection. It means we've got to roll the fiber, and we got to get the fiber to the home. And we've been sitting on this current phase of the internet for far too long. To immediately compare that against what's happening in Washington State. There it goes. All my tabs are all out of whack. Washington State removes all barriers to municipal broadband. They just recently announced the passage of Bill HB 1336. And the state governor, Jay Inslee, I do not know how to pronounce that, signed the Public Broadband Act, removing all restrictions on public broadband in the state of Washington, according to the bill's primary sponsor, State Rep. Drew Hansen. So, moving forward, Washington State can now entertain plans for any collective, any community that wants to roll their own municipal broadband. If private companies are not willing to improve speeds, connect up rural communities, make their offerings more competitive, and there's no competition in that area, this is the next step. I mean, if we want a free market and we want businesses to compete, then they got to compete. If they're not going to compete, we got to roll our own. And now Washington State has basically scrubbed any state law that would have prevented that kind of municipal broadband competition. Huge step, big. And especially for two states out on the left coast, really excited to see those trends starting to garner more momentum. I wrote up articles 7 years ago. So yeah, it was about 7 years ago here. The LA City Council was starting to begin the process of a five-year analysis of what fiber in the greater LA metro area would resemble. That was going to be a five-year study, and 7 years later, we see almost no traction on fiber in California for most residential areas. So without some kind of nudge politically, like, this stuff just languishes. But I'm sure, of course, that there will be plenty of legal challenges from carriers and ISPs. How dare you build a network to compete against something that we weren't going to compete against? Boo. Yeah, Paul Puri, public broadband is a great way to diminish the digital divide, get sued by cable cabal. Yeah, these will absolutely be challenged. But at the same time, if you weren't going to compete, I feel like there are stronger and stronger legal precedents to suggest that communities should have the access and the ability to roll their own. And until some other force comes in to compete for broadband, cable companies have no incentive to improve their offerings. Like, you just sit there and they raise your prices, and your service really doesn't get any better. It just keeps getting more expensive while they continue to reap larger and larger profits and then still get public tax dollars to do nothing or to do very little, I should say. So I'm hopeful. Like I said, my new place is like within spitting distance of fiber, but we don't have access to it at our new home. So I'm hoping in the next year or two, this is the kind of move that will help encourage rolling the cable across the street so that my neighborhood can get hooked up. All right. Real quick. Another little follow-up. This wasn't too surprising, but it was one of those things. You have an executive order. you change presidential administrations, and there needs to be kind of some kind of follow through. Some executive orders take time to sort of implement and then need to be carried out by their predecessors. Some executive orders just get struck down. And we talked about this on the podcast. When it comes to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, I believe there needs to be some reform. An outlet like Facebook can claim that they're just distributing content, but then they also editorialize the content, and then they also label the content, and then they can also remove content. So they're acting as an editor, but they're purporting to be a distribution platform. They're getting to have it both ways. So there needs to be some refinement of Section 230. These are the internet protections that keep Google from getting sued for what people might post on sort of public, or not public, but I should say public-facing private services like YouTube. YouTube is not a public institution. It is a private company. So Trump signed an executive order saying you're not allowed to censor conservatives on Facebook. Problem with that is that it would destroy Section 230 and would do more harm in how content is managed, because it's not that Facebook would just open up and let everyone post everything that they wanted. It would make it extremely difficult, or substantially more difficult, to allow for any content. Like, it breaks the backbone of what liability means in the digital sphere. So Biden has revoked that executive order. This was written up on The Verge by Kim Lyons. The Trump order titled Preventing Online Censorship would have allowed federal authorities to hold companies like Twitter, Google, and Facebook responsible if they were found to be infringing on users' speech by deleting or otherwise modifying users' posts. Trump signed the order last May just as Twitter started applying labels to his tweets. Trump was eventually banned from Twitter for tweets inciting the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. A similar ban by Facebook remains in effect while the company reevaluates it. And so Biden basically just struck this down. That is not the end of this conversation. We still do need to take a more scalpel, grown-up, fine-tuning approach to address some of the issues that we have with social media, with the distribution of online content, with how bad actors can infiltrate discussions around elections or around politically sensitive topics. Like, there's a huge mess, big old mess. But what Trump would have done to Section 230 would have been way worse. And likely, and when he originally did it, we all sort of acknowledged that it wasn't going to be constitutional anyway. What Trump is saying is, your First Amendment rights against compelled speech no longer matter. So free speech kind of operates in two directions. You know, you have the right to say what you want without getting thrown into jail by the government, but that's a public relationship. It has nothing to do with the terms of service on a private company's service. There is also a protection in legal history against compelled speech. That is a part of your First Amendment rights. Not necessarily explicitly stated in the First Amendment. What we're talking about is case law over generations that has supported the idea that the government cannot force you to publish something or to say something that you don't want to say. So if someone is delivering seditious speech or is spreading lies, I have to suffer that person being allowed to spread lies, right? According to the First Amendment, that person cannot be thrown in prison. The flip side of that is the person who's spreading those lies can't force another company to publish their lies if that company decides that it's bad for them to publish lies. Those protections go both ways. So what Trump was trying to do is an end run around the First Amendment for his own personal benefit, which shouldn't be surprising because that was kind of the Trump modus operandi. So something to keep an eye on. We need a lot more discussion and refinement for how online journalism should work, on how online commentary should work. I think we need more oversight over social media companies with so much data churning, so much personal user information churning. This is a horrific mess of a situation, but at least one step towards normalcy is striking down an executive order that probably wouldn't have made it through the courts on being challenged anyway.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Thanks, Juan Carlos, for allowing me to be part of your show. And I want to introduce myself to you guys. My name is TK Bay, and I've been doing YouTube for quite some time, almost 10 years now. And you can find me online by just looking for TK Bay either on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. But the general consensus is I'm a tech reviewer. I provide an interesting way of approaching tech by the same way you would actually go ask your friend for help. That's generally the consensus of how my channel runs. I review anything from Android, iOS, PC computers, scooters, basically, you know, drones, anything that you think of as consumer tech. I generally try to get my hands on it and share with you guys my opinions. And of course, any troubleshooting or even tips and tricks that can help you enjoy your tech even better. Again, thank you very much to Juan Carlos. But if you'd like to check me out, just look for at TKDSL8655 on Instagram and Twitter, or TK Bay in YouTube.
Simon says, Hypno, I love Trump's new social media platform that definitely is not just a blog that people aren't allowed to reply on. All right. I know I've got folks that are definitely more conservative leaning. And this is where I feel like it's critically important that we separate an individual like Trump from what conservative politics should represent. Because I feel a lot of kinship with kind of some of the older cloth coat ideas of republicanism. I'm a fan of net neutrality because I want a fair playing field for all companies. And I feel like with smart course corrections like net neutrality, we can get back to a freer market. You know, again, it's fine touch scalpel control over certain industries should bring us back to an area where we don't need huge broadsword regulations. And it allows consumers better choices, better competition, and it's not just locked up monopolistic business practices. So, I got to say, though, from the personal standpoint, is that it's been really nice these last couple months waking up and then just not churning through an unceasing feed of political nonsense coming from Twitter. I don't think I was ever going to be particularly impressed with Biden. As a president, like, he's fine, I guess, kind of a status quo, just back to sort of what a normal president should resemble. I don't think he was the right individual to fix some of the specific issues facing us today. I really feel we needed a nerd. I really feel we needed like an Elizabeth Warren to come in and address like systemic issues in the banking industry and the finance industry, looking at what's going down with the stock market right now. But at least waking up every morning, I don't have a tirade of tweets coming from Biden that makes me exhausted before I've even had my first cup of coffee. So we'll call that progress. Just resetting some of our political discourse and dialogue is close to progress, I guess. So, yes, Simon says Hypno, scandal fatigue was a thing. McCorkran 3, I've been a lifelong Bernie fan. Again, it's not to take away from any of the other players, because I feel there were some strong options in international politics where I think Elizabeth Warren probably would have been a little weaker. I don't feel, again, this is relitigating the primaries and we don't have to go down all of that, but I just felt Elizabeth Warren demonstrated practical solutions for finance reform. And to me, that's one of the major issues facing politics in our country is how money gets thrown around. And that to me, like, you start out with that as like one of the core systemic issues of our political process. And Bernie is incredible, but Bernie is a little bit more of a burn an institution to the ground kind of guy. Like, he's still a bit more of a revolutionary. Right? That's why I love his personal politics. But when I was really looking at what I felt would be the appropriate fit for the United States in course correcting over the last 4 years. To me, I was leaning more towards Warren. Not that it matters, because I guess Biden's fine. All right. You know, this is hilarious. I've got the article up here. This is coming from TechCrunch. Clubhouse is coming to Android. I really put this in here because I thought I was going to talk about this a little bit more. I don't know. I don't want to be dismissive. I don't want to, hey, do we even care? Is this a thing? Do people care about Clubhouse anymore? It's like so 2000 and late. I'll just say, like so many other niche media distribution solutions, going back to Vine, where I totally called Vine's demise. I was a year off, but I predicted that Vine would not be sustainable. I hope Clubhouse can figure out its issues with moderation, with consumer privacy, with data security. I hope they can become a singular platform for town hall style conversations. I don't know that they can course correct for their original promises. Like, this was built on FOMO. It was iOS only. It's all on the promise of getting access to famous people and access to billionaires. And you're going to get so much knowledge with this access, which to me was gross. It's really, I mean, like, it kind of gave me some sick flashbacks of how Hollywood worked when I was working at a talent agency. It's like, if you run a workshop and you've got acting students, you can't promise them that your workshops are going to give them a career. But you can promise them that if you take my workshops, you'll have access. You'll be put in front of big time casting directors and talent agents. No promises that anything's going to happen for you. They're going to get to see you. and just Clubhouse kept kind of feeling like that, which leaves me feeling kind of gross. Again, there are many reasons why I took a step away from working in Hollywood. But one of the contributing feelings was just like, you've got to hustle so hard to sell the lifestyle of Hollywood to people that may or may not ever be successful in that realm. So there's a part of me, because like every competitor, Facebook is going to have a version of this. Twitter has Spaces. I mean, Amazon, I think, is doing an audio town hall platform podcasting service. I think Spotify was toying with some kind of, you know, listener interaction or conversation style platform too. I'd like to see an app come out where they only focus on that, where it's not an add-on to another established service. I think there's a benefit there. I think there's a goodness there. There's a lot that Clubhouse needs to figure out. I think it took them way too long to bring Android into the fold, because they basically gave Android users over to Twitter. And I think it's hilarious. Let me go back into this article real quick. I think it's hilarious because Clubhouse has no way to make these conversations internal to Clubhouse. So when they announced this town hall where they listed off all of the things that they were going to be talking about, they didn't announce it on Clubhouse. They have no infrastructure to tell people on Clubhouse, tune in to the Clubhouse town hall. So they went out to Twitter. They spread the word on Twitter to tell people about what was coming in the Clubhouse town hall. So there are huge, ginormous issues with content discovery, with building and maintaining relationships, with content that is of its time in that moment, that content exists only for that time. So if you're not on at the right time, you don't get to hear the thing that you want to watch. I really love this idea. I love the human voice. I love telling stories. I love listening to stories. I love engaging and participating. I love bringing people together, cross-pollinating ideas. I really want for Clubhouse to succeed. I'm not seeing some of the moves and some of the course corrections that would indicate to me that this is an app or a service that is going to grow in a healthy fashion, as opposed to becoming just sort of a niche, smaller, under the radar kind of community, which is increasingly difficult to find or to discover the kind of stuff that you'd want to listen to. Aditya Anil, hashtag some cross-pollinator guy. That definitely does seem to be one of the phrases of this week's podcast. Man, my voice is raw today. Loki Ted, I have no qualms if Twitter Spaces is doing what Clubhouse does. I mean, again, it's not even a particularly grand new idea. I mean, if you're a fan of using Discord, you already have Clubhouse. You know, like jump into voice chat on Discord. Ta-da, you've made your own Clubhouse. It's just more, I like seeing where platforms can enable this and make the discovery easier. I'm so often promoting and conversing on Twitter that having that be an option on Twitter, it just makes sense. Like you can jump right into it. I spend a lot of time just kind of lurking on Discord, and you know, when I have the opportunity to, and my voice isn't blown out from podcasting, I can jump into a voice chat. I like the idea of Clubhouse being its own solo player, but they went so long letting every other social media company kind of catch up. And they're only just now starting to get to a point where they can really offer the service to the majority of smartphone users on the planet is awkward. So yeah, you know, like I'm probably more likely to engage with Twitter Spaces, and it's already in my Twitter. Like I can already do it. I don't have to wait or hope that they support my phone. So I do want to just kind of knock out a quick subreddit plug. We're not going to do the same gimmicky, I totally won this week because I didn't win this week. A number one on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, LG desktop mode and G8X powering two keyboards, a 34-inch monitor, speakers, two mice, and two keyboards. Hashtag use your phone from user alternative farmer. Just shared a couple photos of a setup where they are using a G8X to power a desktop setup. And it's flipping rad because you can do a heck of a lot more with your phones these days. And the G8X is still a stupid powerful phone, which is likely being underutilized by people that are just average consumers. Just great. Like this took the subreddit. People wanted to see this, and I'm so glad that this is what rose to the top. I've been asking like more written articles, more editorials. Not everything has to be video after video after video. And this came out with just like, here are a couple photos of my setup, and it's pretty sweet. I really dig that, you know, people are sharing those types of experiences because it brings to light, you know, ways that you can get more gadget bang for buck. So the rest of the subreddit this week was pretty strong for me. My fake reviewer YouTube drama video and my shutter speed versus frame rate video took second and third. Grant likes tech. This is a fun video. Again, you want to talk about like trips down memory lane. Grant does a sort of a comparison photo shoot going from the LG V40 to the V50 to the V60, just looking at different photos and video and image quality. That was a fun kind of look back. My OnePlus 9 Pro review also did pretty well too. And then La Planet Arts did a camera review of the OnePlus 9 Pro. This is someone with 3,000 subscribers, and I believe it's like a 20-minute video, just talking about what actually sets the OnePlus 9 Pro apart. A lot of hardware discussion, a lot of like, hey, you know, this is 12-bit RAW, so you can do this with the editing And this is how you can also like kind of present photos, and it looks really professional. And this is coming from someone who claims to be a professional photographer, and they shoot good content. Like, it looks really clean. So just another take, you know, from all of the techies that have been panning the OnePlus 9 cameras, I have to believe at this point that those individuals are horrible photographers, or they're just astoundingly bad at tech. Like, I find very little to suggest that a OnePlus 9 is not a beautifully competitive sort of smartphone shooter in this day and age. All right. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, growing every week. Every week we get to talk about new content, new submissions. We're seeing more upvotes, you know, a lot more of these posts are hitting double digit upvote scores. The participation is critical. We're now being rounded up to 1,800 members. We're somewhere like 1779. We're 1,779. So subscribe, share, participate, comment, but don't be stingy with the upvotes. It's huge when someone can get a bit of a bump for one of their videos on Reddit. It's really a good feel. See, this is what I don't understand, Simon Says Hypno. So Simon Says Hypno says, but specs. The OnePlus 9 cameras win the specs. Like, the main shooter, where is it? My 9 Pro. The OnePlus 9 Pro main shooter is a micro step behind the main camera on a Galaxy Ultra. And the ultra wide is like nothing we've ever seen before. This absolutely wins the ultra wide showdown, unless we talk about Huawei phones that we can't really buy anymore. Nothing, I mean, hardware specs, nothing comes close. And the software game has gotten so much better. So you might be more familiar with iPhone software, but let me tell you, OnePlus 9 to iPhone 12? I don't know. You've got a main sensor and an ultra wide. I think the OnePlus 9 hardware advantage for most shooting scenarios takes the win over the iPhone's tiny sensors with OIS and better software. It's so funky, like, to try and get a good, well-meaning comparison between those two phones is very difficult, because everyone knows, just sort of at this point, it's osmosis. You kind of know what an iPhone camera is like, and so few people really take the time to familiarize themselves with the feel of a OnePlus camera. But if you ever shoot on a OnePlus 9 or a 9 Pro, you got to play with the ultra wide. It is like nothing else. You know, 4K 60, 8K video, it better low light capabilities, even for having a smaller aperture and that wider field of view. I mean, macro capabilities, your close focus comes from this 50 megapixel ultra wide camera. It's just stunning what you can do with it. I'm going off on a tangent and reiterating, but oh, Gabaletta, the S9 Plus has DeX. My mother was looking for a new laptop replacement, but she didn't know the phone could be used in that way. How huge? I mean, seriously, you get a little monitor and a little keyboard and mouse, and it is just so accessible to fire up DeX, or LG, it's now called Screen Plus. I mean, it's so good. And again, you're kind of neck and neck with kind of, you know, inexpensive Chromebooks. And many times you're probably more powerful than an inexpensive Chromebook. McCorkran 3, we'll use this to kind of kick off a little bit of a conversation on the gadget block. Are you at all disappointed by the 888 and the heat issues, or has that been improved with updates? I'm asking about every phone with the 888, not just the OnePlus. 888 is still concerning. especially going back with the Black Shark 4 on the 870, I've shot a bunch of stuff recently, and I went back to my V60 on an 865. Who could even use a Snapdragon 865 in 2021? I just saw another one too. It's like Galaxy S20 Ultra. Is it still good enough in 2021? You know, it was a $1,500 phone. Shut up. I am actually properly concerned about the A88. The issue still does seem to come down to people being specific about what they use their phones for. And that's hard. Think about how many tech conversations where people are jumping through every hoop and blurring every line to just generalize on phone performance. Going from an 845 to an 855, you could do that. Across the board, the 855 was better. I can't think of a single instance or issue where an 845, where you couldn't predict the 845 would lose. Going from an 865 to an 888 is not the same. Very often, the performance that you get in an app is going to be about the same. And sometimes an 865 can win. And sometimes an 888 can win. So if you don't know where an 888 can win, you might overbuy for a phone that underperforms for your needs. And this is why I'm just so desperate for anyone else to do performance testing, because we need more data points. And it doesn't work if all you're doing is some limited, quick synthetic benchmark. Because what has improved, these newer CPUs from the 865 on have gotten really good at big scores in very short, tiny, quick tests. What they have not improved on is more sustained use. You're gaming for more than 2 minutes at a time. If you're cutting up a quick video, like using Frame.it, this week's sponsor, I'm not going to go through another Frame.it thing. They got their plug at the top of the show. But if you're doing a lot of work like that, you're wanting to make your TikToks nicer, you're wanting to do walk and talk vlogs on YouTube, you're wanting to stream directly, like IRL stream to Twitch, you would want to know what kind of video and content capabilities, because those are longer term uses. Those are longer form uses. And that's not where 888s have improved. Again, it's very application specific. Now, some of the other things do seem to be better, though. You know, like a lot of the AI processing, a lot of the radio management, that kind of tech seems to be better. But we're already working from such a big battery penalty on big GPU and big CPU that it's hard to untangle, like, slightly better radio management, but probably at the expense of battery life. That's a tough choice. I mean, really break that down. You get slightly better throughput on 5G and better connectivity on Wi-Fi, but you might nuke your battery 15% faster. And so ask someone out in the field, like, do you want 2 dB better reception to the cell tower, or do you want your phone to last an extra 3 hours, 2 hours out in the field? That's hard. All right. Moving right along. So, really sad. I packed up a bunch of my phones. Like, the bookshelf over there is my phone museum, and it's empty now. I've got them all kind of boxed up, and I'm hoping that they don't jostle enough that they all turn on. Cause that makes me twitchy. Like, phones might be doing alerts or alarms, or, you know, maybe one phone just runs really hot cause those batteries are starting to get really old. Boxed up all my phones. I took a little personal trip down memory lane with my little LG collection. And then the news came out that there's going to be a limited run of the Velvet 2, or what is kind of generally being called the Velvet 2 Pro. Now, this is coming from Frontron. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Frontron on Twitter that is, they're calling it the Universal Second Gen LG Rainbow and the V700N. So I would have assumed that the V700 would have been the V70, which I don't believe is what's being sold here. But apparently about 3,000 of these were being made. This looks like a Velvet, just with slightly deeper camera modules. So instead of the bottom two cameras being flush with the rear of the phone, they do have bulges, like the stovetop rings stick out from the back of the phone. But it's very much built on the Velvet design language. They're being sold for around $170, but they're only being sold to LG employees. And there are apparently extremely strict rules on whether or not these will ever get sold. If you're an LG employee, you're not allowed to resell them or ship them outside of South Korea. Believe me, I've asked numerous LG employees, on background that I can't name their names. And so far, no one's budged on trying to hook me up with a Velvet 2. But it made me really sad because I had this beautiful little collection of LG devices kind of going back to the Optimus days, and I won't be able to add the last phones that LG ever made. I'm going to be keeping an eye out. I know for a fact that at some point, maybe years into the future, some of these are going to start popping up like on eBay and stuff. Like someone buys it at LG, eventually leaves the company. They don't care if LG's gonna like fire them, so they'll sell their silly Velvet 2 and probably for way more than they bought it for. And maybe keep an eye out. I've got like a little pocket idea of how much money I could maybe throw at a Velvet 2 after the fact. See, that's what I said, Michael. They should send you one. They should send you a review copy for old time's sake. I was speaking with one of them. He was like, "Yeah, that's why we loved you. You were such a super fan. You know, just all the best wishes. And I hope you can fill that LG gaping hole in your coverage." Like, thanks. You don't understand how insulting that really sounds when you say it like that. But I know for a fact that one of these is going to end up like on The Verge. We got a hands-on look with the Velvet 2. And you're like, see, being a super fan doesn't really get me anything. You know, for as much as people are like, oh, Juan's this LG shill. And I did. I got great access to the phones that were being shipped here to the United States and a few of the South Korean variants. It's not going to get me a Velvet 2. Like, I don't rank for that kind of special treatment. So, yeah. Corcoran, you should start a podcast called The Gaping Hole. Yeah. You don't get rich being in LG sales in 2021. Well, in LG appliance and TV sales, yeah, you'd be rolling in it. No, I mean, like, there are so many sort of, like, ideas of videos that I really wanted to include the V70 on, if the V70 were ever going to ship. You know, like, the videos that I'm putting out now talking about camera capabilities. Like, I've got one on aperture. I did that on a OnePlus 9 Pro. There wasn't a new LG for me to shoot that on. The one on shutter speed versus frame rate, I shot on a V60. But a part of that video should have been, here's the new V70. It's got manual video controls, and let me show you how this affects, you know, the content that you produce. And like last year, one of my favorite videos to put together was the showdown between the Xperia 1 Mark II and the V60. Like, those videos I can't do. You know, there is nothing for me to replace where LG would have been. So yeah, there's this big empty pocket of content that I would be planning on shooting right now that I'm not going to be able to. And so I even just have to find like new relationships. Like, I'm hoping I'll get to spend some more time with Xiaomi coming up. You know, Black Shark was really fun to use. I really want to get a Xiaomi with an 888 to kind of add more data to some of my experiences in testing phones. So we'll see how that goes. But what won't be a part of the 888 conversation? Probably. We got a bunch of major leaks on Google's Pixel 6. And so, hold on. There we go. Sorry. Again, my tabs on OBS are all out of whack. Pixel 6 renders suggest a major redesign for Google's upcoming flagship phone. This was written up by Humza Amir at TechSpot. I need to see in the comments right now, what are you thinking? Design language, Pixel 6, are you liking it? Do you like this render? There's a very broad rectangular bulge for the camera modules. It looks like there's a center hole punch. It does look like there's not quite a curved display, but that there are slight tapers to the glass and to the edges of the phone. Not even quite a 2.5D, but the way that these renders look, that there's just sort of corner edge tapering. Raymondit says it looks great. Simon says Hypno says Pixel 6 looks nice. Reminds me of Jordy LaForge. Gabaletta in all caps says Nexus. Bolter saying it looks like crap. Aditya Anil saying it's not for me, but I'll slap a case on it. If you like it, then you better put a case on it. If you like it, then you better put a case on it. Gary the Fireman is saying, give it to me, baby. Doomer is saying the hardware design doesn't bother me, but I'm really concerned about Android 12. We're going to talk a little bit about Google I.O., and I'm kind of with you there. Loki Ted, give me a Cylon edition, red hump and mirror finish. Oh, man. Oh, I want a Cylon version of a Pixel 6. Now that you've said that, I will not rest until I can get... And again, a red border around your cameras would be a terrible idea. You know, any red light reflection hitting the lenses that are super broad on the back of your phone. And now I want that so bad. from 2 Turbo, I hate camera bumps, but but a bump with no table rattle would be better. And I kind of like, you know, when we see this render, and again, it is across the entire width of the phone. I like that idea so much better. Oh man, do I like that better. Every phone that's come out recently has had that offset domino or off-center camera module. And even in a case, you can still have situations where if you don't have a really thick case, or so like this is an Armadillo Tech clear bumper for my OnePlus 9 Pro. The camera module sticks out far enough from the phone that they needed to add an additional rim around the camera module. So even though it's in a case, this phone still wobbles on a table because of how much extra depth you need for crazy large camera sensors. That's insane. That's how far we're getting. But on the Pixel 6, if the rear module just goes across the entire back of the phone, when you set the phone down, it's just going to be slightly tilted towards you. Like, that's actually a perk. It's angled more towards your face. I like this design and I like this language. And from the Pixel 6, what is the Huawei Nova? Thank you. Oh man, my brain is Swiss cheese. I've always liked that kind of visor stripe. The Huawei Mate 10. It wasn't a camera bulge, but there was this beautiful symmetrical glass strip, dual camera sensors, then flanked by flash and focus sensors, and it was super symmetrical. And I like that look. Same thing. The TCL. TCL 10 Pro. I love the way those rear cameras are a horizontal strip across the back of the phone. And I think that looks really sharp. So one of the things though, is when we look at what they're doing with this camera bulge, if they need this additional depth, I think this is a pretty clear indication that Pixel 6 is finally going to walk us away from the camera sensors that Google has been using since the Pixel 2. That's the main takeaway I feel for this design, is you can't increase the camera sensor size and not deal with the additional depth of those lenses working with a larger sensor. So you need to do something. You know, Samsung went with this domino camera module. OnePlus kind of copied them, went in the same direction. Xiaomi, again, like a real big lump of a camera module that sticks pretty far out the back of the Mi 11 Ultra. And we're going to be talking about the Sharp next, the Sharp Aquos after this. So this could be it. You know, people keep saying like, oh, well, I just put Gcam on my other phones and then I get the best of both worlds. Gcam doesn't properly take into consideration the differences in larger sensor design. Gcam is built for a 12 megapixel sensor that's found on the back of a Pixel. It is built and optimized for a 1 over 2.55 inch sensor with no pixel binning technology. So when you pair Gcam with a OnePlus, you aren't getting the optimized version of what that photography should look like. You know, again, a OnePlus can default to a 12 megapixel image. It can put out a 48 megapixel image. It is binning pixels to maximize light or to increase dynamic range or deliver juicier HDR colors. There are so many different things happening on that kind of a sensor, and Gcam isn't built for any of it. So if we see a Pixel 6 with this camera bulge here, this is probably going to be our first foray into Google's computational photography being applied to a larger sensor. I'm going to put it out there. My guess is that they're going to go with a larger but more traditional 12 megapixel shooter. I don't think Google is going to go pixel binning on the Pixel 6. That's my guess. They're going to look at Apple. Apple does fine on the iPhone 12 Pro Max with a 12 megapixel sensor. They're going to look at Samsung on the S21 and S21 Plus. They do fine with 12 megapixel sensors. I think that's what Google's going to do. A Sony, you know, a Sony Xperia 1 Mark II, 12 megapixel sensors. Even though Sony makes some of the best pixel bending sensors, Sony has decided that they care more about autofocus, subject acquisition, speed, and the refinement of that 12 megapixel sensor. I think that's what Google's going to do. And McCorcoran, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. I want Google computational software applied to that larger 12 megapixel sensor. He says, I'll be happy with the larger sensor, even if it's 12 megapixels. And Dave Burns, maybe use the same sensor that Sony used in the 1 Mark II since it's larger. No, that's what I mean. So it's, the sensor in the Pixel 5 is 1 over 2.5 inch. The sensor in an Xperia 1, in a 12 Pro Max, and in a Galaxy S21 is a 1 over 1.72. So it's noticeably larger than the sensor that's in a Pixel 5, but it's not a quad bare. So it's not 48 megapixels that gets squished down to 12. It's just a straight up 12 megapixel sensor. The advantage, it's not as good for a lot of HDR trickery, you know, being able to kind of process light and color. They still seem to be better for autofocus. And I still think Sony has the fastest and scariest version of that. Like, it's just stupid good how quick a Sony can focus.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Mmm, savory, delicious Mega Pickles.
Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. And from McCorcoran 3, what impact will Whitechapel have on pricing, do you suspect? I think Whitechapel is going to help us usher in a Pixel back to premium tier pricing. I'll be very surprised if with in-display fingerprint sensor and probably one of the newer Qualcomm, fancier, ultrasonic, I would imagine that they would kind of bump up on that. Larger camera sensors, a new industrial design, all of the 5G connectivity, it's going to have support for Verizon. So that means it's already going to be at least $100 more than any phone that only supports sub six. And Whitechapel, the development costs that go into Whitechapel. I'm kind of expecting a Pixel 6, like the top version of a Pixel 6, to start at $899 or $999, somewhere in that ballpark. And it might be, you know, $999 with 128 gigabytes of storage. Like, they might be looking at an iPhone 12 Pro, and at $999 versus an iPhone 12 Pro, I think we're in good competition. So all I need from Whitechapel is for the CPU and GPU to be about as powerful as the Snapdragon 855. But what I want on Whitechapel is all of the other custom hardware that Google is really good at. So secure modules for device encryption, neural core, their AI processing stuff. Again, a Pixel 4 XL can still chew up image data faster than 888s can. Qualcomm has done some incredible work on improving AI capabilities. Neural core on Pixel 4 is still astonishingly fast. So if the core CPU experience is a little last gen, you're going to have a bunch of tech nerds coming out of the world. Oh, but my Geekbench scores. Oh, but the Geekbench. And we'll completely miss the point of a phone that just eviscerates image data, that just like consumes image data, like a ruthless machine. So if we could just get like back to A77 cores, that'd be fine. I mean, seriously would be. The farther I get away from the 855, the more that kind of stands out as sort of the perfect all-rounder chip. On-device LTE, radio management. For the Pixel 4, you had neural core. And then processing power, GPU power, that's still head and shoulders above what people will even scratch the surface on their phones. So if Whitechapel's somewhere in there, then I think we're in great shape. It's more, I want all of that custom Google hardware to really justify the move away from Qualcomm. Thermals will be better. Battery life will be better. Image data will just, this phone will drive it like crazy. That image processing, if it's anywhere like Neural Core was, will be insane. And then it's all about software and optimization, because Google will be coding specifically for this hardware. We would have to hope that this would be the most efficient version of Android yet. You know, Xiaomi can't lay claim to that. OnePlus can't lay claim to that. Only Google can. Literally, only Google. And I would be willing to present the Pixel as a premium alternative if that's the argument that needs to be made. We control the chip, so we can give you software updates until we just literally can't. It's like, you can't make that promise when you have to work with Qualcomm. It's more complicated. So McCorcoran 3 is like, I just wonder if they'll be able to keep the prices down with the chip or not. Sacrifice on build quality, I imagine. And I don't want them to. I want them to put out a premium tier device. Like, this is what the best of Google has to offer. And now with custom Google silicon, we need to reset how we talk about price and value. Right now, it's very Louis Vuitton. If it has a Samsung label, it can be worth it. And that's the only time we seem to acknowledge that a premium tier device is allowed to be premium tier. And I don't think the Samsung label carries that much cachet. I don't think it's really a rational, discussion on the merit of that gadget. This is not like I really am getting the most phone for my dollar. it's, you know, Samsung can undercut pricing, offer ridiculous trade-in values, leverage their market position to push out competition. They're not a fancy purse label. So other phones also get to be premium phones. Dave Burns, Google Silicon. I just threw up a little miss me with that silly branding. I mean, I would imagine Whitechapel is what? Probably A78 cores? I don't know. We're talking about ARM processor design. I would love to see them use underclocked A78 with another sort of quartet of smaller cores, A50 series. And it's great. You're going to have incredible performance. DTNL, but the benchmarks. I can already see the commentary panning the SoC because the numbers are in between the 855 and 865. From Root Knight 5, I think the problem with value in smartphones is that the judgment metrics are so disconnected from the actual use of the device, you have no ground to tie your evaluation to. And I feel like that's very common for average consumers. And we've talked about this before. Like, I've got family members who absolutely need iPhone Pros, but their use is not iPhone Pro use. There's an emotional component to the need that is far outweighing the practical benefit of that gadget. You know, it's like, I'm not telling, if you get that dopamine hit, that's what makes you feel good. Go spend premium cash on a phone. I'm talking to techies, and I feel techies should be able to back up those feels with a little bit more rationale than what they currently demonstrate. If it's not like a flagship killer exercise where I need the bestest processor in the absolute cheapest phone, then it becomes a popularity contest, just like a fancy purse. But from people who claim that they're looking at the performance and the metrics and the specs and making a rational purchasing decision, and they're not. They never were. They're trying to make rational justifications, but they did not reason their way into buying a phone. They felt good about the purchase. They felt good when OnePlus was being a snarky little upstart brand, and now they feel betrayed that OnePlus is trying to be more mainstream. That's all marketing. That has literally nothing to do with the daily driver aspects of using a phone. Oh, and Aditya Nil's cutting up video on an 845. Man, that must have taken you like weeks to finish that video, Aditya. I mean, who could even use an 845, which is slightly more powerful than the current mid-ranger chips from Qualcomm in this day and age? All right, real quick, I just want to kind of point out Aquos. The Sharp Aquos just dropped. And let me cue this up here, Firefox. Aquos R6 co-engineered with Leica. So I'm using a translation of the actual Sharp page, kind of forgetting that Sharp has made some really interesting phones in the past. I have never gotten my hands on a Sharp. I really want to take one for a test drive. And this one looks really cool because this is a 1-inch camera sensor. This is the same size image sensor that's going into high-end point-and-shoot cameras, obviously without a telescoping or a telephoto zoom lens, but it's real big. So this is going to be a Snapdragon 888. And I love how they did this. Hold on, let me see if I can find it. Yeah. So a camera that captures the atmosphere and atmosphere. This is a terrible translation. So again, this is not Sharp marketing looking their strongest. But they show you a little image of a 1/2.55-inch sensor. This is what's going into a $1,000 iPhone 12 Pro. A 1/2.55-inch. Now remember, according to tech reviewers, a 1/2.55-inch sensor is absolutely horrifically not worth it on a Pixel, but it's totally fine on a $1,000 iPhone 12 Pro. Not worth it on a cheaper Pixel, worth it on an iPhone. Pixels don't score as well for SEO and ad revenue. iPhone coverage makes us a lot more money. But I'm not bitter. So they show off, this is the 1 over 2.55 inch sensor, and then they show us a 1 over 1 inch sensor. How hilarious is that? So, you know, this is, it's described as a fraction of an inch, right? 1 over 2.55 inch. It's a little bit smaller than a half inch sensor. Well, this is a 1 over 1 inch sensor. It's a 1 inch sensor. I'm sorry. I'm so tickled by that. Because it's like, again, I get so cranky when people don't like simplify their fractions. I remember we were talking about phone screens when they started getting taller and people were like, well, you know, it's not 16 by nine. It's an 18 by nine sensor. So you're like, it's a 2 by 1. Don't call it 18 by nine. It's a 2 by 1 sized screen. 1 inch IMID sensor is enormous. You have to think, you know, like you look at the Xiaomi Mi 11 Ultra and that huge lump on the back of the phone is because it has a, what is it? It's a one over 1.2, which is getting real close to that, you know, like a point and shoot, premium point and shoot sized image sensor. And this just has it. So obviously the aperture kind of needs to be a little bit smaller in terms of the ratio. So this is going to be an f1.9, where a lot of our phones can hit f1.8 or 1.7. The actual physical hole on this is going to be much larger than what's on like a OnePlus 9 Pro or a Galaxy S20 Ultra. This is big boy photography crammed into the back of a phone. And then properly, they are claiming that this isn't just a software exercise with Leica, that Leica was instrumental in helping build the lenses and the hardware. So they've got a lot of these, you know, like showing you the ISO range. A larger sensor delivers nicer grain pattern for higher ISO. And they've got like a photo gallery and some stuff to check out. Sharp also makes a lot of really high-end display tech. So they're saying it's a 1 hertz to 240 hertz display. So it's an adaptive refresh rate display that can go up to 240 hertz. And then what was the other thing that I wanted to? Oh, and a 5,000 milliamp hour battery. So again, with all the 5Gs, the Snapdragon 888, the humongous camera, the ultra-fast display, and it has a headphone jack. They don't call it out in the marketing materials, but next to this little USB-C connector, there's this other little circular hole right there where it's going to be a premium phone that seems to have a premium feature in that you can connect headphones to your premium phone. So I am very anxious. You know, like I don't have the biggest budget to buy every single review device that comes out. This one is going on the list. I am very aggressively going to be looking at how maybe I can reach out to Sharp. If I can do a review unit, that would be great. But if I can't, this is one that I think I need to spend some cash on. This is only the second phone to ever get a 1 inch sensor, which is insane. So I'm very, very, very interested in trying to figure out what this camera performance might resemble. I do not know if it has an SD card doomer. They do talk about like what the built-in storage is. But I'm going to be trying to check out, like, you know, it's available through SoftBank and Docomo. So I, And Gary the Fireman, that's what I'm desperate to find out. I really want to know. And Sharp, they're building a premium tier device here. The R6, there's nothing about this that's gonna say like cost-efficient mid-ranger premium flagship, right? You know, this is just balls-to-the-wall high-end. So I really want to know, like, did they put in a high-end headphone jack? I mean, come on. I gotta know. So yeah, I'm going to be working really hard to try and get my hands on one of these. I probably won't be one of the first, but I'll get there eventually. And I just kind of wanted to wrap up our conversation today. Google I.O. starts tomorrow. We got a bunch of you know, a bunch of press releases are going out. A lot of what Google I/O is going to make available is going to be accessible online. I've got the Ars Technica write up here, just like what to expect from Google I/O. And it seems like a lot of this for Android is looking at things like device customization. This is going to be one of the biggest updates to Android since Material Design. You know, it can base UI elements, the look and the feel and the color on your wallpaper. So your customization options are more organic. You put up a wallpaper and then it kind of colors the rest of the phone to match. So some of this is sounding really cool. What I'm going to be anxious to see, and Ars Technica actually does bring this up too. I'll be anxious to see if Google, after acquiring Fitbit, really can resurrect the idea of Wear OS. And what I hope to see is a beginnings of the conversation that I've been asking for years now, where you've got this software platform called Wear OS, but it's only a visual featured operating system for smartwatches. And what I want to see Google tackle is an operating system that you wear. This can become tied into Assistant and be a part of their earbud strategy. Headphones are the original wearable technology after watches, right? So I want an operating system, a series of APIs, commands, integration that can communicate directly to my earbuds. I want accessories that can plug into the Wear OS ecosystem. Like, I don't like tracking steps by swinging my wrist. I want to be able to add sensors to my shoes with UWB technology and have that communicate to a fitness tracker exactly, you know, what my footfalls and what my patterns were. Even get granular data, like, when you're listening to this kind of music, we saw a 3% uptick in step count over this duration of time. That kind of data could really help craft and hone a workout. So what we need to do first is just resurrect the name Wear, Wear OS, and hopefully see some other support coming. You know, Fitbit is brought into the Wear OS fold. There's a Fitbit that runs a proper version of Wear OS. Samsung is still rumored to be putting out a Wear OS watch instead of Tizen. That kind of infrastructure and that kind of support would help tremendously. And then the last one is whether or not we'll be able to kind of bring Android back to tablets. Those are the two biggies for me watching this Google I/O. I mean, I hope we'll see stuff with Nest and with smart speakers and with home automation. Google I/O is always going to be rich for that kind of content. I'm sure we'll get grumblings or you know, Pixel 5a might be announced. Pixel 6 might be revealed, whether or not it's announced or if we start seeing it ship. You know, global component shortages, that I can't really predict. But those are the other two that are really big for me, is I hope to see a renewed interest in getting developers into supporting Wear OS. And then I hope to see some broader support for Android as a tablet resource. Using the Surface Duo completely resurrected my interest in an Android tablet. You know, again, everything that iPad OS does well, in terms of like split screening, multitasking, bringing some more desktop style experiences to a Slate mobile operating system, I've just been so impressed with the Duo doing that very naturally and incorporating this kind of panel, how apps can kind of separate themselves. Microsoft brought Android into the tablet space in ways that Google never could, even down into Office. Like, you can pull up a spreadsheet and a Word document side by side in panels. Like, it's so clean. It works really, really well. So that is hopefully something that can also be revived, you know, something that as Android becomes more the backbone of dual display folding devices we need developers to better support those types of hardware initiatives. And Google needs to lead the way on showing people how to do that. And Doomer, I think that Microsoft Fluent Design is the best, and I want them to also try to make a regular smartphone or tablet. Yeah, we make that joke a bunch of times, but I want a Surface Uno or a Surface Solo or whatever you want to call it. Like, I think there's room there. You know, slap Android on a Microsoft single screen, but you know, wider slate, and I think that kind of makes sense. You know, in given where this market currently is. So, and especially, you know, a number of people are now trying to pick up Duos again because the price cut was pretty heavy. Like, you can pick up a Duo with some earbuds for like $700. And on the one hand, you're like, yeah, I did pay full price at launch for my Duo, but this whole time I've been using it, you know? So from the highs and the lows, some of the best software updates, some of the shakier bug fixes, I'm really glad that I've just spent all that time with it. I would not have been as happy buying the Duo, returning it, and then getting it on fire sale free of that whole other experience. And the number of times it's come in clutch just as another baby laptop has been incredible. Like going over to this new house that we've been renovating the floors. We've been trying to get it all cleaned up. Exterminators, we've got to call a plumber. And I go there with a Duo and a little Bluetooth folding keyboard, and I can write and I can keep up with social media and I'm streaming movies and it's phenomenal. It's really good. So that's the gig. That's what I'm looking for most for Google I.O. So, Dave Burns, thanks. Dave says, congratulations on the house. We're really excited. We're just super stressed out and it's going to be a lot. But that's our kind of last little transition here in the closing minutes and the closing moments of our show. This is Gadget Lab 3 that we're in today. When my wife and I were looking at like our respective careers, I was starting to take some steps away from voiceover production and casting and working in talent and working for talent agencies. As, you know, you were working a lot of projects, but there wasn't always great money for the amount of time that you were hustling on some of those directing gigs. It was a while back. It was, 2009, I want to say, where the income I was making by running my own video production and doing a little light freelance work with a couple smaller outlets at the time warranted picking up a whole extra bedroom. And now, you know, we're having to move into three bedrooms because, like, you know, Lex needs a room, we need a bedroom, and I still do enough work that it makes sense for us to keep an office in the house. And I always had grander designs for what this room was going to do. This is Gadget Lab 3. I still feel like Gadget Lab 2 has been kind of the best execution I've had on this idea. But Gadget Lab 3 never really came together. We had just moved in. Lex had gotten, there was a scare at our daycare. Hand, foot, and mouth disease was spreading through our daycare. So we pulled her out of her daycare early. And then we got hit with the pandemic. And we're talking like from moving in and getting all the boxes in and getting this roughly set up to being on lockdown was a period of a couple weeks. It's like whiplash inducing, just so many life changes all at once. And so the idea I had originally had for this room was a lot more modular, was to make it a more comfortable interview space, to have people over, to do more long-form discussions and podcasting. And instead, I kind of ended up in this halfway compromise of just setting up a table and shooting into that bookcase and just trying to make it through, right? I mean, just like, just trying to keep this whole boat afloat and not really having the resources or a lot of bandwidth to look at a ton of improvements, which the channel needs. You know, my commentary, I like telling stories. There are some things that we need to spruce up in terms of storytelling. So Gadget Lab 3 has basically just been a treading water exercise. And I'm kind of sad. The space is great. The location is great. The sun that comes through in the morning is way too harsh, so I can't really use it for podcast lighting or for early morning recording. But like, there was a lot happening here that we probably could have done better. But instead, for Gadget Lab 4 coming soon to a tech channel near you, what my idea is to simplify. So right now, like if you kind of look behind me, I've got a standing desk that's just put right in front of this bookshelf. These big square cubbies that I've been using for years. And I've got lights on the back of the cubby, so you see this kind of rainbow glow effect that comes off the back. For Gadget Lab 4, what the standing desk does though is it cuts out a huge swath of space right in front of the bookcase. And this room is only 9 foot by 9 foot. So this is not a lot of floor space to work with. And my next office is about the same. It's slightly more rectangular, but it's about the same floor space. So instead, what I'm thinking I'm going to do is I'm going to rip off all of the lighting behind the bookcase. And we're just going to go to using that as a simple bookcase because I'm genuinely going to need it for storage space. So it's just going to be packed to the gills. Boxes, computer components, you know, it's going to look a little like hardware unboxed, right? You know, like motherboards, Lego models. It's going to be a bit busier back there. But instead of having this big table just sort of occupying the middle of the room, instead, what I think I want to do is only put things around the sides, around the walls. And so at any given time, I can set a camera right in the middle of the room. And if I want to do a shot with my workstation monitors behind me, I can do that shot. I can turn the camera 90 degrees and I want to set up a little show desk, you know, like a monitor, a keyboard, a mouse, a fake succulent, but a very simple, clean layout that we can just kind of shoot sort of like what would normally be white box style or light box style photography. Turn the camera 90 degrees. And then there's the bookshelf if I want a busier background for like a, you know, kind of a little bit more visual interest. Turn the camera again to the other wall and we're going to have a TV and a bookcase and the phone library for all my old phones and stuff. And I want the entire middle of the floor to be totally open. And that's what my plan is for Gadget Lab 4. Much, much simpler. I'm not going to mess with cute lighting accents or nano leafs or anything like that. I am going to put some color changing bulbs into the ceiling. And then from there, I want to keep it simple, more organic, and that I'm able to move around this space more freely. And then, you know, TK and I are both vaccinated and I always promised him that he'd be the first to get to come visit. And so I feel like a nice, clean, open space, I can prop up like a little table and some bar and some stools. We can have a podcast just in the middle of the room and not be like wedged into like a wall or to a corner. And that to me, I think is what Gadget Lab 4 needs to represent. It needs to be simpler, needs to be cleaner, except for the bookcase. The bookcase is going to get way dirtier. And then just more modular. What this space always was supposed to be, but for real, big wide open floor and the ability to move around. I kind of want to shoot videos where I can get up and walk around the office and let the camera autofocus fail to keep up with me, but then also show you like stuff that's happening as I produce these videos. So that's the gig. We're saying goodbye. I'm a little sad because I've just been so claustrophobically attached to this condo. You know, Lex has spent almost a quarter of her life in these walls, you know, like very little going out. We took her to an In-N-Out Burger last week. It's been over a year since we've gotten to go to an In-N-Out Burger and sit outside on a bench and eat a cheeseburger. And I hate myself for this, but I also kind of love it that like she's taking a bite of a burger and I'm just snapping photos like an idiot. Like, I need to document the first In-N-Out cheeseburger my daughter has eaten in public in over a year. Like, that's ridiculous. That's where we are. Like, psychologically, I'm having to get over this agoraphobia of having worked in this space for just so intensely for so long. So, more to come. Some I'm very excited about these life changes. They're super stressful. They're totally wigging me out. I hate that I have jury duty the same week that we're moving. But I'm maybe the most hopeful I've been in a while. Just that it's not about getting back to normal. It's about finding what our new normal is going to be. And it's the right time to make a big life change, like move. Just, we got to reset our brains. I don't know that I would recover as quickly in this space, because this space has been all about confinement. It's been all about quarantine. And so now it's time to move on. And with moving on, I want to move around more, and I want to breathe more, and I want to stretch my legs literally and figuratively, you know, as someone who needs to be working out more and as someone who is feeling a little stymied creatively. So I'm really stoked to have so many people along for the ride. The people that have been joining these conversations, supporting this channel. I'm really looking forward to telling stories again, not just reviewing products for the sake of reviewing, but trying to find something else about what it is that we enjoy in this hobby. And knowing that, like, I've got a lot of people here, Dave Burns Fitness Challenge. But knowing that we've got an amazing crew here, this is an incredible collection of people that are down to try. It means everything. I mean, like, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't feel like there were some other folks out there who kind of felt the same way. So, I might not be back next week. With the move and with jury duty, I just don't know. Like, if I get called in to actually sit on a jury, we won't be doing another show Monday morning. We might need to reset it for Tuesday morning or like Monday evening. So I will be vocal on social media just to let folks know if next week's show gets interrupted. But yeah, it's going to be huge. And oh my goodness, Paul Puri. Whoa, dude. Hold on. I need to drink some water. Paul Puri just gifted subs to Tommy Oliver, Tech Valor, Root Knight 5, Nom, TK Bay, Hi 217, Mr. Malignance, Vazicos 8, Fat Produce, Billy Quizboy, Hime 333, Loki Ted, Walt Samarista, and Skate or Die. Paul, you just rocked my socks, sir. Thank you so much. That is epic. And Fat Produce! Fat Produce just gifted a sub to Doc Harris GLK. You guys, we're going to make some cool stuff. I've got people subbed to this channel. We're going to do cool things. And once I'm in that new home, I'm not completely surrounded by boxes. We're getting back to game nights. We're getting back to movie nights. We're getting back to more community-driven stuff. I don't know, maybe I'll do wacky dances on TikTok. We're going to blow it all up because I'm ready. I know you're ready, and it's time. It's time to try again. So thank you so much. I feel like that's probably the best place to wrap this up. I want everyone here to have an incredible week. So much progress is being made, but we still have ways to go to look out for each other, to take care of each other, check in on your neighbors, check in on your friends, check in on your family. We're going to be recovering from the mental health aspects of the last year for years to come. And we can do it. We can do it together. Like, no one's an island here. I'm striking up text conversations with people that I haven't spoken to in months. And it feels good. And there's finally some hope. And it's not just a Zoom call where we all go, I don't know. Good to see ya, I guess. We're finally taking little steps again, and it means everything. So I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you all back here sometime next week, but maybe not on Monday, for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And I'll catch you back here next week. I love you all. Oh, and major thank you to Frame It for sponsoring this week's episode. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.